You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Okay, so James 4, verse 13, James says, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you don't know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him, it is sin." Well, that seems a little extreme and kind of catches us off guard. And we're like, so we're just supposed to make the exact right decisions. Otherwise, we're like really arrogant and in sin for some way. And like we've talked about many times with James before, you take him at his first reading and you feel like he's kind of yelling at you, but you get in there and you're patient with it and you ask the word to explain itself. And it turns out that we will find, as we found many times before as we go through this book, that James actually has very profound wisdom that's available to anybody who's willing to look for it. So, let's just take some time to go through the details of this passage. He says, going back to that very first verse, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit." And so he's specifically talking to people who are reading this letter who are thinking about moving to another city. And, you know, back in first century AD in the Roman Empire, to move around was actually pretty dangerous and pretty risky. But he has more of a problem with it than that. And so we kind of want to unpack why it is that he thinks that there's something wrong about the way his readers are going about some of their decisions. And so with this verse, we kind of want to start with the end. Oh, here's the point. Is he against making plans? He says, you know, today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a city. Well, if you read the Bible, you see that people make plans all the time, sometimes for things pretty far in the future. You know, you read about somebody like King David, who he made a plan to build the temple for God, and God said, no, I don't want you to do it. I want your son to do it. And so what did David do? He spent a long time at the rest of his life building up materials and resources for his son to use. And so he was making plans for the future. And so it can't be that the Bible is against us making plans. Is it against us moving to another city? Well, again, if you read the Bible, you see that people in the Bible moved all the time. And that actually seemed to be a pretty common thing, that God was calling people from one city to another city. Even in the New Testament, the apostles like Peter or John lived in various cities throughout their ministry. And a guy like Paul, it was hard to even know where he lived at times because he moved around so much. So it can't be that James is against people moving to another city. Is it that he's against people engaging in business? Well, Paul was actually a business owner at times because he made tents. And so it can't be that it's bad to engage in business of some sort. What about, is he against people making a profit? Well, if that were the case, then the most spiritual people you know would be the people who lost the most money if they owned a business. And that doesn't seem to make any intuitive sense to us. And so it can't be that either. And so what is it specifically that he has a problem with? Well, when we read this verse, it's helpful to put it in the context of James itself. And in verse 13 of chapter 3, he says, "Who among you is wise or understanding? Let him show by his behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom." And so the book of James is really about two different kinds of wisdom. You've got godly wisdom, the wisdom that God himself offers as he teaches us how to live life with him. And then you've got what the Bible calls worldly wisdom, what people come up with on their own as they try to figure out life on their own apart from God. And so we've been reading about different ways to live. Are we going to live according to worldly wisdom, or are we going to live according to godly wisdom? And so as he's talking to his readers, the problem is not which decisions they're making, it's how they're making them. And so that's really what we're going to unpack tonight as we talk about how to go about making godly decisions. And so in this verse, as he talks about the various factors in their decision, we want to start with the end where he says, you know, you plan to move to another city. And why? It's because you want to make a profit. And so problem number one with their decision making is they just have the assumption that more money will make me happy. I just finished Michelle Obama's memoirs, Becoming. And it's a really interesting story because she was raised in a relatively poor family on the south side of Chicago. And by the time she was in her mid-20s, she was still single, but from the world's perspective, she kind of had it made. Because her parents made sure that she got a really good education. She was able to get into Princeton and got her undergrad degree from Princeton University, at which point she then went to Harvard Law School and then came back to Chicago as a single black woman and got a job with a very prestigious law firm in Chicago where she was making a ton of money. And then a dear friend from college died, very unexpectedly. And she recounts a conversation that she had with her mom in the car, where she was kind of taking stock of her life. She said, "With that, I unloaded my feelings. I told her that I wasn't happy with my job, or even with my chosen profession, that I was seriously unhappy, in fact. I told her about my restlessness, how I was desperate to make a major change, but worried about not making enough money." And what did her mom say? "If you're asking me," Mrs. Robinson said, I say make the money first and worry about your happiness later." Now, what she doesn't talk about is if her mom had any valid concerns. Like, Mrs. Obama never says anything about any student loan debt that she had, and that could be one concern that her mom has. But look at the underlying assumption that they both had. She thought, go to a prestigious university, get a prestigious degree, get a high-powered job that makes a lot of money, then I will have arrived. And she got all of those things, and she was realizing, I'm miserable. And then she tried to talk to her mom about it, and her mom's like, don't worry about being miserable. You need to make money. And so we have to take a step back and ask, does money make us happy? You know, last week, all those quotes from wealthy, famous people who were profoundly empty and unhappy. And so on the one hand, you read that and it can be kind of shocking because our culture tells us the more famous and rich you are, the happier you're going to be. On the other hand, who knows? Maybe there's a lot of really wealthy, really famous people who are actually fulfilled and happy. And when it comes right down to it, are we really going to trust somebody like Russell Brand to give us our direction on life? So those quotes, while notable, are not quite enough. It turns out that there's scientific research demonstrating conclusively that more money does not make us happy. Daniel Kahneman and August Deaton are two professors and researchers at Princeton at the Center for Health and Well-Being. Daniel Kahneman is an economist, and he's like a famous economist, which how you can be a famous economist, I don't know. But, you know, his work is so well known. This is from their research study entitled High Income Improves Evaluation of Life, But Not Emotional Well-Being. And here's what they mean by that. Recent research has begun to distinguish two aspects of subjective well-being. Emotional well-being refers to the emotional quality of an individual's everyday experience, the frequency and intensity of experiences of joy, stress, sadness, anger, and affection that make one's life pleasant or unpleasant. Life evaluation, on the other hand, refers to the thoughts that people have about their life when they think about it. We raise the question of whether money buys happiness separately for these two aspects of well-being. Surveys of subjective well-being have traditionally emphasized life evaluation. And so that's when you kind of take a step back and you look at your life, do I think I have a good life? And previous studies had only measured that aspect. In the present study, we confirm the contribution of higher income to improving individuals' life evaluation, even among those who were already well off. So do I have a good life? Yeah, sure. And the more money I make, the more I feel like, yeah, I have a good life. However, we also find that the effects of income on the emotional dimension of well-being satiate fully at an annual income of about $75,000. And they have a graph that demonstrates this. And there's a lot of detail on it, but I have some explanation. So if you look at the graph, it measures four different things. And the thing that keeps going up and up and up with income is evaluation of my life. And so this is somebody that if they're making $1 million, if they make $2 million, then they're willing to agree, yeah, my life got better because I'm making more money. However, the other three things are the things that measure how happy I actually feel right now. And so the question, am I even happy? Well, that goes up until you reach between $75,000 and $85,000, and then it just levels off. And you don't get any happier on a day-to-day basis. Or what about my life is stress-free? It actually increases until about $75,000, at which point that starts to decrease again. People's stress actually starts to go up as they start making more money beyond $75,000. Or what about I'm not sad or worried? Again, that can increase pretty dramatically up until about between $75,000 and $85,000, at which point it also completely levels off. And so what's so shocking to everybody about these findings is everybody thinks, get more money, you'll be happier. And it turns out that my day-to-day experience, how often they were measuring things like how often somebody smiles or laughs, that it doesn't change at all once you get up to a certain income level. And I haven't read any of the studies on it. The $75,000, and that was 10 years ago, so it would go up a little bit now. That resonates with me intuitively because you get up to that level, and that's the point of income where you don't have to worry about like a doctor's bill coming in and throwing you behind for 2 months. You don't have to worry about a car repair that's just going to throw you off. You know, you have the money to live really comfortably in today's society. And beyond that, it doesn't matter. And so the question, does money make us happy? The answer is no. No, it doesn't. Doesn't matter what anybody tries to tell you. The research is showing pursuing money is not the path to life satisfaction. And yet this is what people in James's audience were making life plans around, maybe without even really realizing it. In fact, they were willing to move to another city to pursue this goal. He says, you're going to go to such and such a city. Kind of doesn't even matter what city you move to. You guys remember the movie Inside Out? This is IMDb's synopsis of it. They say, after young Riley is uprooted from her Midwest life and moved to San Francisco, her emotions, joy, fear, anger, disgust, and sadness, conflict on how to best navigate a new city, home, and school. And I think that vision, that image of being uprooted is pretty helpful because if you think about it, what's happening when you uproot a plant? Well, that's a plant whose roots have sunk down into that soil. And you're now going to try to rip those roots out of the soil where it's been growing and transplant it into different soil and hope that the roots take. And it's possible that there's people in the audience tonight that know what this is like. That, you know, either because your parents went through a divorce or one of your parents got a promotion or a different job in another city that was going to make more money, that you know what it's like to move. You know what it's like to show up in a new school, maybe even halfway through the year, and have to make all new friends and navigate an entirely new neighborhood and figure out where, you know, everything is. And it can be hard sometimes. And, you know, moving is not the problem. Okay, I actually moved a couple of times in my life. I was born in Southern California, and my parents moved when I was a baby to upstate New York. Now, I grew up pretty much in the same house, so I was not somebody who moved around from house to house. But then, like I said, after I graduated high school, I then moved to Pennsylvania and lived a couple years there, and then I moved to Columbus and have been here ever since. None of those were spiritual decisions, but, you know, I actually feel like God was calling me to Columbus because it's here that I received Christ, and so I'm glad that I moved. I have friends that have moved to other cities in the country and to other places in the world, because they felt like that's where God was calling them in order to be engaged in God's work in other places besides Columbus. And so I'm not against people moving. We just need to be aware of what we're pursuing and what it is that we're sacrificing in order to be able to make a wise decision. And we also need to be honest with ourselves that this is something that will run counter to worldly wisdom. That people actually talk kind of despisingly of people who live in the same city that they grew up in. If you ever want to know, get a pulse on what the world thinks, well, where do you go? You go to The Onion, right? Here's a great article from The Onion. Unambitious loser with happy, fulfilling life still lives in his hometown. Here's some choice clips. I've known Mike my whole life, and he's a good guy, but it's pretty pathetic that he's still living on the same street he grew up on and experiencing a deep sense of personal satisfaction. Childhood friend David Gorman said of the unaspiring, completely gratified do-nothing. Former classmates also confirmed that the underachiever is apparently resigned to going to his little, small-time, stable, extremely fulfilling job in town each day and has zero ambitions to leave his position and pursue a more prestigious and soul-crushing career path in a real city. I'm just glad I got out of there and didn't end up like Mike, said Husmer's cousin, Amory Martin, 33, an attorney at a large law firm who hasn't seen Husmer, her closest childhood playmate, for nearly 6 years. The last thing I'd ever want is to have a loving family nearby, feel a sense of pleasure when reflecting on my life, and be the big failure that everyone runs into when they visit home once a year for the holidays. This article also talks about how he had time to do things like spend time with his kids and build a fulfilling marriage and have wonderful hobbies that he really enjoyed. And yet, that's kind of the way the world thinks, right? Is you're still in the same city you grew up in? Like, don't you know that what Americans do is they move to a big city where they don't know anybody? And The Onion, this is not a Christian publication, and yet even they are like, I wonder if there's something wrong with that thinking. Maybe there's people that are happy. And so making money is part of the problem, but it goes even deeper than that. James says, you don't know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. So their problem is they thought money would make them happy, but another problem is I have limited knowledge about the future. I have no idea what my life will be like tomorrow. And I'm trying to lay out my plans for the next 5 to 10 years and determine exactly what the steps are. Let's just think of some things, I guess I should say some things I can't control about tomorrow, not all the things I can't control about tomorrow. One would be my physical health. My physical health now is a gift from God, and I will probably wake up tomorrow morning, but maybe I won't. I don't know. I could walk out of this building right now and get hit by a car. I don't know. I have no idea what even the next hour holds, let alone the next year or the next 5 years. This was an article I saw a while ago in People magazine. This was an up-and-coming chef. His name was Eli Culp. He was named like one of Bon Appetit's top chefs of the year. He opened up a couple of restaurants in like the Philadelphia, New York City metro area. He was getting rave reviews. He got married. He and his wife had a kid. He headed into work one day. He called his wife on the way home saying, hey, I'm heading home. And he got on the train. And he got on the Amtrak train that derailed. And he lived, but he'll spend the rest of his life as a quadriplegic. When he went into work that morning, he didn't know that was going to happen. And that could happen to any of us. So our physical life is something that we just don't know. Other people's choices. We can make all the plans we want, but then other people's choices are going to impact our lives. I actually experienced this in a very literal way about this time last year. This is the car that I was driving. I was driving north on Indianola, and I was doing everything right, okay? I had my seatbelt on. I had my phone put away. I was going the speed limit, and so I was completely aware of everything going on around me, and I was approaching the intersection of North Broadway and Indianola, and I saw that the light was green, and so I was proceeding through the light because it was green, and that's what you're supposed to do. And at that point, the guy who was sitting at the red light going east on North Broadway decided it was his turn to go. And he just pulled out right in front of me. And it was a kind of a snowy day, and so I knew if I swerved, I'd probably lose control of my car. And so the only thing I could do was slam on the brakes and T-bone the guy. Now, I had an airbag, I had my seatbelt on, and so I walked away from that accident. I was sore, but I was okay. If I had died, my last words would have been, oh, no, no, because I saw it happening. At least I didn't swear. But, you know, you can do everything right and something like that could still happen. And what are you going to do? And so it's not just examples like that, but, you know, there's a lot of decisions that we make that involve other people. You could decide to work for a company that looks totally secure, and then they decide that they're moving 500 jobs overseas and you just get laid off. And it kind of doesn't matter how good an employee you are. Or what about my favorite? There were a couple different guys that I was pretty sure was the one, and it turns out they didn't think that. And so it didn't matter what I thought. Their choice in the matter was also really relevant in a decision like this. And so, you know, you only have so much control over the outcome of a lot of things. Or what about even something as insignificant as the weather? You don't even know what the weather's going to be like tomorrow. You ever try to plan a vacation? I'm going to go to the beach, and I'm going to spend 3 days on the sand, and I'm going to surf, and I'm going to swim, and then we're going to go into town, and we're going to have, you know, visit these great restaurants. You ever have those vacations where you get there, and you're like, well, I guess we're inside the beach house the whole time. This is not how I thought it was going to turn out. And so there's a lot that we just can't do anything about. So we have limited knowledge, but it's not just about the future. I have limited knowledge even about what I might want. Think about where you were 10 years ago. Picture your life 10 years ago, and then try to remember what you thought your life would look like now. I would never have predicted where my life would end up. And in fact, if you told me certain things about where I'd be at now, I would either laugh in your face or I would get really angry. And yet, what life am I living now? I'm living like the best life ever. And God's like, you don't know what you want. Just follow me, and you're going to end up with something really, really good, even if it's not what you expected. James also says you're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. So problem number three with this kind of decision making is my life is so short. A vapor. That's like if you go outside right now and you breathe out, and that cloud that hangs in the air for a split second and then is gone. In comparison to eternity, that is your lifespan. That's how long you have. Moses says in Psalm 90, teach us to number our days so that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Our choices change, like we talked about last week, if you consider them in light of eternity and what it is that we're really working for. And not even in light of eternity, but just think, when you're lying on your deathbed, what is it that you're really going to think about? What is it that you're really going to regret? It's not going to be stuff about your success or your money, because that will all have faded at that point. What you're going to be thinking about are your relationships and what you've accomplished there. And none of this is to make us anxious. James is not trying to turn us into an anxious mess who just can't know what to do about our future. But it's just that it's more comfortable to ignore these truths about how short our life is and how uncertain it is while making decisions. And he just wants to draw us into the greater reality that we have a lot less control over the future than we want to admit. And that should give us humility in making plans. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. And so this brings up the fact that God has a plan for your life, which brings up the question, is it a good plan? What if I turn my life over to Him? Am I going to get good things? And verses like Romans 8:31 speak to that, where Paul says, he who did not spare his own son, but delivered him over for us all, how will he not also with him freely give us good things? And so we wonder, God, do you have good things in store for me? And he's like, well, I already gave you my son. I was willing to sacrifice him for you. And so if I was willing to give you that, everything else, that's peanuts compared to sending Jesus. And so we can trust him with the plan for our life. And so we want to spend the rest of the time talking about what it looks like to trust God with the big decisions in our life. And it starts by trusting God with your eternity. When Jesus was here, he said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." You know, we're out there, we're living our life, we're doing our thing. And we think, well, you know, maybe at some point I'll get right with God. Maybe at some point I'll figure that out. You know, maybe if I'm a good person. And Jesus is saying, well, it's not about being a good person or a bad person. It's the fact that because you're out there doing your own thing, you're actually alienated from God. And you need to be reconciled to him. And the only way to be reconciled to God is by approaching Jesus, because he's the one who died for us. And his death was what paid for our sins. And so God says he wants to be reconciled to us, but it has to be through his grace, which is his free gift of forgiveness that he willingly offers to anyone who is humble enough to accept it. And so we want God to show us what to do, but God says it has to start with a relationship with him, that's the most important decision, and everything else flows from that. So that's the first most important foundational decision. And then where do we go from there? For those of us who have already made that decision, well, one is a heart attitude that we need to be inclined to follow God. People say things like, well, God is everywhere. I'm sure he'll be wherever I go. Well, that's true, but you have to ask who is following whom here. I'm not an expert on the entire Bible. I have read the whole thing, and I have yet to find a single verse that says that God wants to follow us. It's always the other way around. So what does it mean to be inclined to follow God? Well, in his excellent book, Knowing God's Will, Blaine Smith says, until we reach the point of being willing to do the difficult thing, our minds are often not able to think clearly about our options. So if we just feel super confused, it could be that we haven't actually gotten before God and said, I need to wrestle this out with you. Do I even want to follow you here? In practical terms, I believe this willingness really amounts to two things. First of all, I must do what I already know to be God's will. And so we're asking for God's guidance, and God says, I've showed you a lot of things about what it means to follow me, so why don't you start there, and we'll get into the more complicated matters after that. And second, I must be willing in advance to accept whatever alternative God might show to be his will, even before I know what it might be. Because what do we want to do? We want God to lay out his plan for us, and then we can decide, do I approve or discard this plan? And God's like, that's not the way that I work. So one experience that I had with this is I had a pretty good corporate job, but I had failed out of school. And so I didn't have a college degree. And it turns out that I was really, really close, way closer than I thought I was. And so my very supportive husband kind of almost forced me to go back to school. And so I was in school full time. I did not have a job. He was working in software, so he was supporting us and paying for the schooling. And about a month before I graduated, I started contacting my old company. And they had said, oh, let us know when you want to come back and we'll hire you back. So I started sending emails and I wasn't hearing anything. Like nobody was even responding to me. And right in that interval of time is when our church approached Scott and said, would you be willing to consider coming on part-time to start teaching some Bible classes? And he was in an interesting position because the software company that he was working for was a relatively small company, and they had made it pretty clear, we're grooming you to take over the company. We will sell this company to you, you know, I don't know when, but at some point in the future. And so he knew that taking the job teaching the Bible would mean that software job, that's gone. And yet we had to make the decision as to whether or not we were going to accept the Bible position before I had any idea if I was going to get a call back. And so we had to kind of wrestle it through, like, do we believe that God is calling us to this? Because if we do, we just got to go for it. And we sought out advice and we prayed about it and we talked to people and we thought, yeah, this is what God's calling us to do. And so he he went in and he talked to his boss, who was a believer, and she was super supportive, but she said, okay. And he was able to keep working there part-time and then work for our church part-time. And while he was in talking to his boss, basically going down to part-time and kind of quitting, I got the email that they wanted to bring me in to interview me for like 5 different positions. And so it was not, are we going to hire you, but what position are we going to hire you for? And I really believe that God very specifically engineered it that way to ask, do you trust that if this is how I'm going to lead you, that I'm going to take care of you? And I'm really glad that he engineered it that way, because our faith grew through that experience. So we need to be inclined to follow him. We also need to just seek out guidance through his word. He's not trying to hide things from us. Psalm 119, 105 says, your word is a lamp for my feet and a light for my path. So it's like we're holding a lantern, and the word will show us the next step or two that's right in front of us. And what do we want? We want like a spotlight that's illuminating the whole path. And instead, what we have is the next step. And you take that step, and then there's another step in front of you. And you take that step, and there's another step in front of you. And so turning to his word and asking, are there passages that apply to the decision that I have in front of me? Is there any wisdom that I can glean is a helpful way to approach things. Also, just ask God through prayer. You ever have that happen where you're trying to ask advice from a friend? What do I do about this? What do I do about that? And they say, well, have you prayed about it? And you're like, no, maybe I should do that. Earlier, remember what James said? He says, if you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all generously without reproach, and it will be given to him. And so we feel like God's will for us is like some sort of hide and seek game where we're tracking him down. And God's like, I want to tell you things. I want to be involved in these things. You're just not asking me. And so how do we do this? Well, you can just ask God, what do you want me to do here? Do you have any ideas or input? You know, I'll be like, well, I could do this or this or this or this or this. And then I feel like God doesn't show me anything. And God's like, well, you've been so busy talking, I haven't been able to get a word in. And I'm like, oh, maybe I should try listening. Or what about just prayerfully making a pros and cons list? Write out what are some good or bad things that could happen as a result of this decision. Because when it's in my head, it feels like all murky. And it feels like, well, there's some good things, there's some bad things. But then sometimes I list it out and I realize there's a lot of things in the pros list and hardly anything in the cons list, or vice versa. And I'm like, oh, well, that's a lot clearer than I thought it would be. Or you'll notice situations where a lot of the positives in the pros list are, you know, maybe some temporal things or some worldly things, where all the cons are spiritual things. Or again, vice versa. And so it can help clarify our thinking to actually get stuff out in writing. And it has to be prayerful. God, please help me think of the things that will be affected by this decision. And then I also think it's important at times to say, well, I don't feel like I'm getting clear guidance. I will keep moving forward tentatively. So just please shut the door if this is not the right move. Now, I don't think that's the same as I'm going to do what I want and God will stop me if he feels like he should. That's not as humble as this, where sometimes there's a couple of options in front of me. Do I go for this major or that major? Do I ask this girl out or not? I don't know. And so we think, well, I'll just take some sort of action. And I've had this happen. Again, in my career, I'd be like, well, I don't know if that's the right job to go for, but I'll just interview for it. And if it's not the right move, I pray you would show me that. And the jobs that were not the right fit for me, or that were going to require way too much travel or overtime or anything like that, it turns out I wasn't even offered those positions. And I was able to say thank you. So we can just ask God. It's also helpful to ask godly, mature people. And notice the words I used for the recommendation for which people to ask. Godly people who are relatively mature. It's all too easy to go and ask the people who are going to give us the answer that we want anyway. And that does nothing in helping us make wise decisions. All that does is let us do what we want and feel like we checked off the seek counsel box. In Proverbs 11, it says, in an abundance of counselors, there is safety. Or what about Proverbs 12? A fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to advice. Now, asking godly, mature people, you're not trying to get people to make your decision for you. Because you know what? You're the one that has to live with it. And I have people come and ask me for advice, and I can sense sometimes when they just want me to tell them what to do. And I'm like, not my life, dude. You got to make your own decisions. And I'm not always even right as to what God is calling people to do. But what's great about going and talking to people that I trust is they're going to be able to think of things that I never would have thought of. Because I don't know everything, and I'm not perfectly wise, and I'm limited in my perspective, especially if it's something that I kind of want to do anyway. And so to get some people that I trust to talk through different possible outcomes can be really helpful. You can also just ask yourself, what do you want? Or what do you like? Psalm 37 says, delight yourself in the Lord, and he'll give you the desires of your heart. There's this weird Christian asceticism that seems to think that I need to pick the thing I like the least in order to be, like, really holy or something. And so I need to find a major that I'm really bad at so I can work at a job that I'm going to suck at, and I got to marry somebody I don't even like. And then I'll be really godly. And God's like, what kind of God do you think that I am? I have really good things for you, and I want you to have a good life. So why would I direct you that way? When I was single, I had this fear that I would have to marry somebody who was short and fat. And everybody who's laughing knows that my husband is really tall, like freakishly tall. Not just tall, but like can't even find clothes that fit because he's so tall. But okay, here's the thing. The real fear was I'm going to have to marry somebody that I'm not attracted to. And it's not, I didn't marry him because of his height. That was just, you know, a side bonus in my mind. But why would God say, I want you to find somebody that you are not attracted to, that you don't really like spending time with, who you don't have anything in common with, and I want that to be the person that you spend the rest of your life with? That's not the way that God works. God's like, I have good things for you. I know you better than you know yourself. And I want to bless you. I want you to have a joyful life. And then, finally, I would say we need to hold all of our plans lightly. We can make our plans, but to hold them with some sort of clenched fist and decide, this is what I have decided, even if it's with God, is not the way the Christian life works. Proverbs 16, verse 9 says, we can make our plans, but Yahweh determines our steps. Things change all the time. Including me, I change. And God is the only one who knows that. And so we can list out our desires, we can make our decisions, we can keep moving forward, but God has the authority to change direction for us anytime he wants. And it can be a big change, it can be minor adjustments. We need to have the humility to submit to that. You know, the irony is that we're so worried about where God will take us when the truth is that trusting God actually relieves our anxiety. Think about what Jesus says in Matthew 6. He says, therefore, I tell you, don't worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They don't sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not more valuable than they? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? It's like you guys get all twisted up because you're trying to take care of yourselves, and you were never designed to bear that burden. You're trying to take care of yourselves, you're trying to plan out your future, and that's not your job. God is committed to taking care of you, And he is committed to leading you into a good life if you're willing to follow him. And so when James says, instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that, that's actually a position of profound peace. That we're submitting to God, that we're willing to go his way, that we're willing to turn the reins of our life over to him because we know that we belong to him. And it turns out that that's actually the path to the good life. And so in summary, you have one life to live. This is your shot. God's plan is the safest way to live because he knows the future. He knows exactly what it is that he is leading you into, and he'll take responsibility for that. And God's plan is the most joyful way to live, which is what James wants for his readers, and it's what God wants for us today. Yeah, Lord, a lot of times we do want you to reveal your will. Thank you that you have revealed yourself through your word, that you have made your character so clear through thousands of pages of scripture. Thank you for the ultimate revelation of yourself, which was your son. Grateful for how he entered into human history to rescue us so that we even have the chance of knowing you and then being in a relationship with you. And Lord, there's a part of us that knows that your will for us is best, but it can be really scary to trust that sometimes. It can be really hard to believe that you have good things in store for us. So thanks that you go out of your way to reassure us, even though you do not need to stoop to that. Thanks for how patient you are with us. And thanks, too, that you promise that if we seek you out, that you will meet us more than halfway. And so pray, Lord, that you would show us what it looks like to trust you and to follow you so that we can see how good and pleasing and perfect your will is. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.